Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Lisa Simeone. In Dante's Inferno, the first of the three books that make up the epic medieval poem, The Divine Comedy, Dante travels through hell and describes what he sees there. There's fire, of course, plenty of fire. But it's not just one big, all-consuming flame. There are different levels, different circles of hell, and Dante carefully delineates each one, describing the sinners and their sins from the most tame to the most egregious. In the eighth circle of hell, Dante leans over a ledge so far he's in danger of falling over. So his escort, the poet Virgil, pulls him back. "Who are these people?" Dante asks. Virgil replies, "There are souls within those flames. Each sinner swathes himself in his own torment." Even though the sinners in the eighth circle are considered pretty bad, this is a sentiment I think we all can relate to, that of tormenting ourselves for something we did or didn't do. And even if we're not into tormenting ourselves, there are plenty of other people out there willing to do it for us. It's hard not to think of Dante's Inferno while listening to today's program, which is about the monumental fires that raced through Southern California in the summer of 2009. When such periodic fires occur, people who live outside these regions wonder how anyone could possibly live in them. Don't they know what they're in for? Aren't they just courting disaster? In today's Soundprint, we meet some of these residents. From producer Eve Tro, this is Feet First.
When you say Los Angeles, most people picture the beach, a row of palm trees, or the concrete swoop of the freeways, not the mountains. But four mountain ranges sit in Los Angeles County. They're like the backyard of the city. You can get to hiking trails in just about 15 minutes. Well, if there's not too much traffic.
You are shedding like a fiend. Yes, you are.
All right. Well, Lila, we're going to go up to the cabin.
Yes.
Lila is a German Shepherd mix. She belongs to Bronwyn Acre. I met them just off a freeway exit on a busy road called Foothills Boulevard. It brushes up against the San Gabriel Mountains. For Bronwyn, the mountains aren't just a retreat. They're her home.
And going as we go down the hill at the bottom, it will veer to the right and turn into Big Tonga Canyon Road.
Once we pull into the canyon, we're instantly small. Bronwyn's sport utility vehicle is a speck between the tall, steep slopes. The land is vast and empty.
We get a lot of very independent-minded people up here. So there's a mix of tight community and also isolationism.
What you have in common is that you like your space.
Bingo. Bingo.
But she also says people stick to this place like glue. They come to visit and never leave. That's what her grandmother did in the late 1970s.
My grandmother was born in Hollywood. Her parents were avid hikers. So all during her growing up years, she was spending a lot of time in the San Gabriels. When she was in her 60s, my grandfather had died, and she'd remarried, and things weren't going well, and she decided it was time to make a clean break. So she ran away from home.
And she ran to a campground in Big Tahunga Canyon.
So she packed her dogs into the camper, came to the campground, and there was a for sale sign for this place. So she sold her house, bought this one, and lived here until she died. She died here.
Bronwyn was with her grandmother in those last years as her caretaker. For about the past 2 years, she's lived here alone.
This is my house. You can see the large oak tree sheltering it. I've known these trees longer than I've known most people. And I've been coming up here for 3/4 of my life. We had the joke that we literally went over the river and through the woods to Grandma's house.
The house is built from huge wood beams, 4x10s, with red trim.
The living room has a vaulted ceiling, A-frame. The fireplace is to die for. I've never seen anything like it.
It's made of big, smooth rocks from the riverbed behind the house. Go downstream a bit, and you see the place that Bronwyn's neighbor, Beth Hollis, bought about 16 years ago. Her husband, Robbie Driscoll, moved in when they got married, about 8 years ago.
I was living in Montana at the time I met Bess, so I had to move back to Southern California. When I saw the canyon and Bess' home, I said I could live here because it's away from the hustle and the bustle. And
very, very quiet. a stream or sometimes a river running through the backyard.
They remodeled the house together, and Robbie's come to love the mix of people who live in the canyon.
In the 50s, it was beatniks that hung out there, 60s, the hippies, and then a lot of the baby boomers started to discover it. We had people from Hollywood living up there in the motion picture industry, and attorneys, artists, firemen, an eclectic group of professionals. A lot of us are just drawn to the nature. Plus, I don't have to use a little baggie to pick up my dog's poop.
He's a business consultant. Beth is a social worker, getting her doctorate in education. One of those artsy couples Robbie mentioned lives further up the road in another pocket of cabins.
I'm Jane Fontana.
Mark Fitzsimmons. She bought the house not long after we met.
Almost 6 years.
And we got married 2 years after that.
Both of us always loved nature and we loved to hike, but I don't think we really started becoming naturalists until we started living here.
Mark is an engineer and a wood sculptor. Jane is a musician and composer. She works in an upright piano just off the kitchen.
Even just if you stood here right now and just took a deep breath, there isn't all that polluted noise that is present in the city all the time. Most of the stuff I do here is I write little cues for TV, but on really good days I write real songs.
That's just the way that you learn. Smiling while watching it burn. Turning away from wherever you are now. You know you can never return.
Things don't always feel free out here. Big Tahunka Canyon is part of the protected Angeles National Forest. That means fees and permits, extra insurance that can cost thousands of dollars, and work. On a Saturday afternoon, chainsaws kill the peace and quiet. Jane, Mark, and a small crew cut tree branches and rake leaves to keep the house up to code.
Uniform requires that you not have any brush within 200 feet of your house. And the Forest Service doesn't like you to have any leaves.
That's because overhanging branches or dead leaves can ignite a house if summer wildfires rip through the canyon. Bronwyn Aker says residents often have to get out.
The Forest Service can say that your special use permit is suspended. Well, in the event of extreme hazard, that's exactly what they do. So there are all kinds of restrictions because Uncle Sam is my homeowners association. It's one of the prices of living in paradise.
This is part of canyon life, knowing that you will have to leave. You need safe transportation and a place to stay indefinitely. If you have animals, which lots of people here do, dogs, cats, rabbits, horses, it's even more of a hassle. And I say hassle instead of horror because most of these threats never hit. They're usually more inconvenient than scary. But the last week of August 2009 was different.
Update on the fires, 3 in Los Angeles County, 1 in Riverside County, but first...
Several wildfires broke out in the hills and mountains around Los Angeles.
Some of the resources are being shared between the Morris Fire and the Station Fire. You can really get early containment when you hit a fire early on.
Firefighters are getting a handle on the Morris Fire in the Angeles National Forest, but the Station Fire near La Cañada is completely uncontained right now.
Okay, the most active fire is, of course, the Station Fire. Unfortunately, I wish I had a better number to give you, but it's 0% contained.
The Station Fire started late on a Wednesday night. It grew quickly on Thursday, but not toward Big Tahunka Canyon. Attention was on a wealthy suburb on the other side of some mountains. Firefighters from around the state were called in. Bronwyn Aker says from where she sat, the fire didn't move.
The fire crested the ridge. It sat up there for 2 days. And we could see it. And we watched it.
That Friday, firefighters went house to house to talk to residents about their plans. Beth was alone. Her husband, Robbie, was finishing up a summer trip in Montana.
There was a presence of firefighters, and they walked around the property and said, oh, well, this place, you look okay because there's defensible space, and just shut that door on the shed. And I had put photos in the car that night and probably didn't sleep real well that night, kind of with one ear to, you know, whether we'd hear a bullhorn saying, you know, evacuate or something.
Firefighters told Mark and Jane the fire might reach the canyon sometime in the next week.
2 o'clock in the morning, we took a drive up and watched some pine trees exploding way at the top of the ridges, but it was still moving really slowly. It looked really hot and big, but not fast moving. In the morning, the guys came at about 9:30, that was Saturday morning, and told us that they thought the fire would be here Monday. Before we left, they said, close all the windows, rake all the leaves away from the house. And we worked on that, and we also packed the cars.
Then the script changed.
At 11:30, they came back and said, you have to get out right now. We're all going to die, sort of. I mean, they didn't quite say that, but they said, now. And we're going to wait here with our siren on until you do.
And around 11 o'clock, I got a call because firefighters had stopped by and said, you know, you maybe have about a half hour.
Beth called Robbie. He was stuck at the airport in Las Vegas.
And when Beth called, you know, she kept giving me, well, it doesn't look good, but she'd been through this before. I'm thinking it's not going to get the canyon. Canyon hasn't burned in, what, 65, 85 years. The firefighters told Beth our home was defensible.
All three households evacuated.
The power had already failed, so we had headlamps on because it was like dark night, even though it was noon. And we said goodbye to the single fire engine that was here for about 55 homes.
This burned so fast and so hot, nobody could stay. The firemen couldn't stay. Nobody was here.
The fire is getting real close to that house.
Yeah, but we don't have enough water.
And then we stopped to look back and see if we could see anything. It looked like the whole canyon, about 4 miles wide, was on fire. Flames were probably about 120 feet high. And our house was in there somewhere.
It had sat there as the 90-pound weakling of fires up on the ridge for 2 days, and it lulled all of us into a false sense of security. You know the scene in the Ten Commandments when the parting of the Red Sea comes back together? That's what the fire did. We all ran for our lives.
I snapped a picture of where we measured the kids in the doorway in the laundry room. And looked at some stuff, and I had some things, and took a couple pictures of things on my cell phone, which are kind of shaky pictures. And I made a decision to lock the door, and I remember thinking how silly that was.
Dozens of homes burned to the ground that day. Two people in the canyon didn't get the message to evacuate. Their bodies were badly burned. Two firefighters died trying to outrun the flames in their truck. It went over a steep mountain road. The station fire was all over the news, but specific information trickled slowly. Residents relied on email, text messages, and word of mouth over the next 24 hours. Bronwyn got word from neighbors who she ran into at a shelter.
I'd gotten to the point where, okay, it's a total wash, it's completely gone, and now I just have to move forward. Thank God I have my health, thank God I have my dogs. My neighbor, Shane, he had gotten an email from the ranger, and he had let us know which houses were still standing. And when Shane called me and said, your house is still standing, the world literally shifted. It was a vertigo moment. How could anything survive that?
She went to see for herself a few days later. The landscape was bare, smoking, and alien. An oak tree by her house smoldered. The canyon was hot as an oven. When she saw her house, her jaw dropped.
I didn't even have smoke damage. I had closed up all of the windows, and there was a smell, light smell of smoke, like from a barbecue. That was it.
That email from the Forest Service arrived in Jane's inbox, too. Hers was the first house on the list. 11 homes in that corner of the canyon burned. Just hers and one other were standing. Jane and Mark caravanned out a few days later with neighbors who lost their homes.
A lot of people have asked us why you, especially our neighbors, like even our next door neighbor's garage, which is between our houses, burned down.
There was a thermometer on the back of the house that was stuck at 170 degrees, and the paint was bubbled. If it had gotten just a little bit hotter, I think the house would have burned.
After evacuating on Saturday, Beth picked up Robbie at the airport and went to a hotel. That night, they found out their house was gone.
We began to see the news broadcast, saw NBC and CBS showing our home, you know, smoldering. And
Robbie said, "Beth, those are your dishes sticking out." Yeah, there they were.
They went to the fire station to complain that the media got to see their home before they did. And California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was there. He got them permission to visit the next day.
NBC had set up actually in our driveway.
There's all these shiny lights and brightness and people right on our property, like on it. I can't just explain how intrusive it was. Robbie just, he went ballistic. He said, you know, get the blank off my property.
The two fire people that took us up were absolutely remarkable. He went over to the producer of the NBC show and he said, "This property is sacred to these people and you need to get off it now." I thought, profound words from a man that understands the depth of the loss that we were experiencing at that time.
And then days later, again, a press conference on their house. Governor Schwarzenegger and his entourage walking on the ruins.
We had been out there, and I'd been able to find some things. I found my baptismal cross that I wore, something I didn't even know where it was, and I found it, you know. But there were all of a sudden all these people walking all over what looked like a bunch of crap and junk and rubble, but that was what was left of our home.
There's no clear pattern that explains what the fire ate and what it didn't. Half of Beth and Robbie's front gate burned, but not the other half. While residents inspected the damage, the flames raged on. It took 3 weeks to put out the station fire. It was the biggest blaze in Los Angeles history. More than 6 months later, residents have major questions about why the flames weren't contained before they swept through Big Tujunga Canyon.
You know, had it been a street of bigger, beautiful, more expensive homes in La Cañada, they would have been all over that street, but it wasn't.
Beth Hollis thinks her neighborhood got lost in the mix of local, state, and federal bureaucracy handling the fire.
I think someone just forgot it existed. That just makes you feel like it could have gone differently.
Other people from the canyon feel officials downplayed their loss, saying only a handful of recreational cabins had burned.
The incident commander spoke, and he didn't seem to know where Big Tujunga Canyon was and that there were cabins and houses here. He thought, well, there's a horse corral out there somewhere and a pump house, you know. The fire chief is saying three homes have burned. When you know already, because you're receiving emails from somebody who was here, that 45 houses have burned.
You hear a lot of these guys talk about the fog of fire, and you know what I think it means? It means they didn't really plan. They didn't have an emergency plan. They didn't know where the houses were. And so when they say fog of fire, it's a smokescreen. It means we didn't know what we were doing because we didn't really plan. We weren't prepared.
I talked to the firemen who were here who left, and I thanked them because they were really doing what they could do. They were one engine. They'd never been here before, and they told us some good stuff to do that probably saved our house. All they were was sorry. They just felt terrible. I hope that the people above them have as much conscience.
Residents are pushing for a congressional investigation into just what happened that day. They say the station fire doesn't prove the canyon is too dangerous to live there. The real risk was putting faith in the systems that were supposed to protect them. Those same systems now control rehabilitation for the devastated landscape and community. Mark and Jane are in the canyon as much as possible these days. They've seen change already.
This was all gray, covered with ash. Every single leaf had burned that was on the ground.
and green.
Yeah, all this green that you see started growing just 2 weeks after the fire. In fact, there are some irises over there, plants that normally don't bloom except in April or May, that all bloomed immediately after the fire.
Forecasters expect the heaviest rain in a succession of storms to pound the area later tonight and
they're
tomorrow.
They're working with the National Weather Service, and they believe that there's a second band of intense weather that they expect to hit this area
later. The pummeling kind of rains like we're feeling today, and that they're feeling up in the foothills, especially areas that were scarred and bared by the fires of earlier this year.
And where are you seeing the absolute worst of it?
Sadly, in the areas just above the station and Morris Burn areas. And
when the rain comes, the Forest Service makes them leave, five times already since the fire.
They're not lifting any evacuation orders yet. They want people to stay alert and stay off the streets and stay out of
slides in the La Cañada Flint Ridge area. No major injuries to report. A couple of homes have been damaged, according to fire officials, with debris flows up to 4 feet high in some areas.
With just one neighbor left, leaving feels more risky, too.
Well, for one thing, there was a lot of looting, and we actually were broken into one night, which is unusual because before that, when I bought my house, the lady I bought my house from didn't even have keys because she never locked the door. It is quieter and more remote and darker and all those things without neighbors. It's not really a neighborhood anymore. Now it is a remote cabin.
It would be nicer if there were more neighbors, and I hope that our neighbors rebuild because it's lonely here.
They feel they owe it to their neighbors to continue to fight for the lifestyle they all used to share, but they face criticism for it.
On the internet, of course, where you get the most extremes, I read a lot of those comments just as I was reading about different facts about the station fire, and there are quite a few people who say, what are you living out there anyway for? And boy, if they were here and lived my life, they would know why. It's because it's amazing here.
It's a hard life. There's a lot of work. We're working all the time to just maintain things.
It's part of this. Part of this is the effort.
As for Bronwyn, she rarely comes to the canyon now.
At this point, I come out to check up on things, to meet with people. It's kind of hard to come out for fun when your house is boarded up and you can't get into it.
She's taken a full-time job and rented a house about 30 miles away. When she does visit, there's a security checkpoint.
I'm a resident. Okay.
As we drive along, Bronwyn stops suddenly.
Wow. Holy criminy.
All I see is a road with sand that's level or a little higher on each side of it.
This stream of sand used to be a culvert 15 feet deep. So we're looking, what, 20, 25?
A culvert, she tells me, is a channel that's supposed to let water run, but now it's full.
With sand and small rocks. They've actually scraped. You see how the ridges are on the outside? That's because they had to bring dozers to scrape down to the asphalt.
And that's why Bronwyn's not in her home. Even though it survived the fire, it's by a river in a floodplain that could fill up like this, too. She has plywood over her windows and a padlock on the gate.
Come.
Good girl.
Although I'm sure this lock is new. Prior to the fire, I never worried about locking the place up, but we've had a lot more looky-loo traffic. I'll show you exactly what the flood hazard is. More than just water, because of the lack of vegetation, the soil can soak up enough water that it will begin to flow. It will basically liquefy, come down, and mow through here.
The first time it rained, she got a moving truck and put most of her things in storage. She struggles to pay rent somewhere else, plus the fees and permits on the cabin, not to mention all the constant worry. A financial advisor told her she should sell the place.
I love it, and part of me wants to be free of it. It's just hard. It's been my home, and at the same time, yes, it is a burden. And I don't know what to do. I'm not the calm, grounded, centered, peaceful person that I was just 5 months ago. I can't be. And there's no end in sight because should I sell it? Should I keep it? I've never lived in any place so long, and I've never loved any place that I've lived so much or so deeply.
Most people whose houses burned can't rebuild. Either Forest Service regulations don't allow it, or they don't have enough insurance to cover the cost. Robbie Driscoll and Beth Hollis debate whether to go back. They're living in a suburb of Los Angeles, in a house just a few hundred feet from the freeway.
We rented this place about 5 days after our house burned down.
Her 14-year-old daughter is in school and likes the new place. It's easier to hang out with friends, and getting pizza delivered is awesome. Robbie and Beth's 5-year-old son, Robert, misses his treehouse, but he thinks it's cool to watch the planes pass overhead. And Beth is focused on her work, school, and the kids.
Where'd my other plan go? Here we go.
At the dining room table, Robbie sits alone and draws plans for a new home in the canyon.
This is good enough.
He's been working almost full time on rebuilding there, from digging up old permits to haggling with insurance companies.
We want to start this spring. We're considering what type of home we want, how simple. We're going smaller versus larger. You know, people go up there now and it looks like a bomb went off, but 5 years from now, Mama Nature is going to be back. And you can't stop the water flowing in the stream. It's going to flow. The trout are going to be there this spring.
But Beth is having a hard time dreaming.
I mean, it just doesn't look that attractive. You know, the dead trees are still there that need to be taken out. You know, is it going to look like the old burnt out house we used to have? And, oh, there's a new house in the middle of it. I don't know. I mean, you know, we're going to spend money to build on that property again. What if the neighborhood doesn't come back? Or they just come back once in a while? Am I going to want to live out there? Robbie, he dreams. He's a good idea guy. I'm just looking at him like, you're crazy. I'm more the glass half empty.
Opposites attract. And Beth brings me back down to earth, but then it doesn't matter because I'll go and do it anyway. And someday she'll just drive up there and see 10 citrus trees all planted, being watered. And, you know, 30 years from now when I'm gone and she's an old woman, you know, she can remember we planted trees on our property to bring it back.
Feet First was produced by Eve Troe. The show was mixed by Jared Weisbrot. It airs as part of our special Global Perspective series, At the Edge. You can listen to this program anytime you want, and all the episodes from that series, just by visiting our website, soundprint.org. CDs of Soundprint episodes are available for a small fee by calling toll-free 1-888-38-TAPES. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. We love hearing from you. The best way to get in touch is by email. The address is talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is production assistant Nkechi Mogekwu and audio engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Lisa Simeone.